We're very pleased at this time to continue our study in the book of 1 Samuel. We're beginning in the 12th chapter of 1 Samuel, and the setting for this passage of Scripture is that the people have assembled at Gilgal under Samuel's instructions. Saul has just won a very great victory over the Ammonites, and this great convocation at Gilgal is witness to the fact that Saul has now been anointed as king. He officially and publicly, in the view of all who care to see, has been placed into this office of king. Well, this means a beginning of the not only the kingdom of the people of Israel, but it is a diminishing and an end to the era of them being ruled by the judges, Samuel being the last judge. So Samuel takes an opportunity now at this great gathering at Gilgal to speak to the people. This is going to be Samuel's farewell sermon to that great assembly of people. It'll also be the sermon that will be the coronation sermon for Saul to begin his true reign as king. So the first verse says, "And Samuel said unto Israel, Behold, I have hearkened unto your voice, and all that you said unto me, and have made a king over you." So he reminds them that he had been very obedient to their demand, to their desires, even though it was against the will of God, even though it was against the will of Samuel, even though the people didn't have any just reason to want to do this. God had instructed Samuel to go ahead and give them the king. And so Samuel says, "I've hearkened to your voice. I've done all that you asked me to do. I've made a king over you." So we're going to see that Samuel is going to now use this occasion to exonerate himself, to show that he had done no wrong, that he had not abused his office of judge and priest, that he had truly dealt with them in a holy, just, efficient manner. Verse 2, "And now, behold, the king walketh before you." This is the way you're going to go now. You're going to be led by the king. The king is going to be your leader. He'll be the one that will be the most prominent person in the land. He'll be making the major decisions as to what to do with the government, as to how to handle the problems of the nation, as to how best to defend against those that would invade the nation. This is the way the thing's going to be now. You're going to have the king to walk before you. He further says, "And I am old and gray-headed, so I'm not long for my position as judge. I'm going to phase out. I will rapidly be diminishing now. I'm old and gray-headed. I will no longer be the one that will be guiding you in these matters that the king's going to be in charge of." And then he says, "And behold, my sons are with you." Now, the sons are the ones that they'd had some kind of a charge against. They had a grievance against the sons. These sons had been guilty of lucre. They had taken bribes, and they had given a just judgment. They'd perverted judgment. And so Samuel simply says, "My sons are with you." They now are a member of the populace. They haven't fled and run off as though they were not going to be willing to face any wrong that they'd done. If you have anything against them, they're here, they're with you. You can bring it up, you can try them, you can force them to pay back whatever they might have wronged you in. They're here, so you won't have to complain about that. My sons are with you. They're a member of the nation just like you are. And he says, "I have walked before you from my childhood unto this day." Now Samuel reminds them that he'd been a judge for a long time. He'd started serving this nation in the capacity of their servant at the temple under Eli. He had at an early age become a prophet, and none of the words that the Lord gave him fell to the ground. And so he says, "I walk before you from my childhood unto this day." As soon as he was weaned, he was turned over to Eli at the tabernacle to be a full-time servant of God. So from his childhood is a very true and accurate statement. Here's a man that spent all of his life in the service of the people. And it was not right to imply that he'd done wrong, that he'd done a misservice, or that he had ruled improperly. And so he's going to take this occasion to show that he had done them no wrong. Somebody may ask, well, if Samuel was so good, why did the people want a king? Why did they want to replace him? Why did they want to change this type of government? And in order for there to be no misconstruing of the thing, Samuel here exonerates his name and publicly declares that he is free from any kind of guilt. Verse 3, behold, here I am, witness against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Now, if you have anything that you want to bring up against me, if you have any point that needs to be clarified, if you have any question about my honesty and my integrity and my faithfulness to the duty, now is the time to bring it up. Bring it up against me before the Lord, and bring it up against me before the king, before his anointed. This is your occasion. If you have a complaint against me, against my office, against anything that I've done, now let's hear it. I'm here. I'm ready to be tried. I'm ready to be accused of whatever your accusation may be. I'm ready to exonerate myself. And so he further does this by saying, whose ox have I taken? Or whose ass have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or of whose hand have I received any bribe to blind mine eyes therewith? So he just simply asked these questions. Have I taken anything that I shouldn't have, that wasn't mine, that wasn't rightfully mine? Any animal, any ox, any ass? Have I defrauded anyone in any way? Have I taken money that I shouldn't have taken? Have I overcharged, or have I pretended to render service I didn't render? Have I defrauded anyone? Have I oppressed anyone? Have I given the wrong judgment? Have I judged someone too harshly? Or maybe have I perverted judgment some way? Have I oppressed anyone? Or did I receive any bribe from anyone that would blind mine eyes? And as we know, those who take bribes are blinded in their judgment. They're no longer qualified to be a true judge because they've been blinded by having received the bribe. But he denies having done anything like that. I haven't received a bribe from anyone. Nothing has happened to blind mine eyes to give the proper judgment. And so after asking all these questions, he says, and I will restore it you. If you can show that I've done anything wrong, I'll repay you. I'm old, I'm gray, I'm diminishing, but I'll pay you back. Anyone. Now this is before the whole congregation of Israel, that is all the representatives who'd come to Gilgal, and so this word would spread to all the nation. Verse 4, and they said, thou hast not defrauded us, nor oppressed us, neither hast thou taken aught of any man's hand. So after putting the question to them and giving them an opportunity to accuse him of anything that they might have thought he'd done wrong, now is the time to bring it out. They then denied that he'd done anything wrong. Thou hast not defrauded us, nor oppressed us, neither hast thou taken aught of any man's hand. This should have made Samuel feel very good. This should make anyone who has been put into a public trust and put into a position of to serve others, to have them to tell him, no, you've done us no wrong. We don't have any complaint against you. We have no grievance. We have no evidence of any wrongdoing whatsoever. We do not have any reason to complain about you. And he said unto them, verse 5, the Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness this day, that ye have not found aught in my hand. So here he calls God to be a record. He calls God to be a witness that you haven't found anything this day to be a blemish on my record or on my character. And so you've set it here before God. God is witness of it. You've set it here before the king, and he is also witness. So there'll be no way that somebody can come back and say, well, we did have one thing. They have now witnessed before God that there is nothing that they have against Samuel. And so Samuel has clarified and exonerated his case before the people that whatever reason they chose a king for, it was not because he had wrongdoing. It was not because he had abused his office or his position, it was not because he had in any wise placed a blemish on his record or his character. And they answered, "He is witness." So the people now admit, yes, he is the witness. God is the witness. Saul is the witness. And so the matter is now closed forever. There is no way that they can legally or morally bring a charge against Samuel. Now that Samuel has sufficiently secured his own reputation, he now proceeds, instead of scolding the people, instead of upbraiding them for their unkindness to him, he sets about to instruct them and to keep them in the way of their duty so that this change of government would be the less damage to them. Now the question is, what shall the people do, even though they have a king, even though they've disobeyed God, but God has allowed this king, what are they to do now? So verse 6, "And Samuel said unto the people, It is the Lord that advanced Moses and Aaron, and that brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt." So he reminds them of some of the things that happened to them in the past. All of the problems that they've had in the past that they've been able to be secured out of, all of the troubles that they've gotten themselves into that they have been saved from, it was the Lord who saved them. It was the Lord who brought them out. So he says, "It's the Lord that advanced Moses and Aaron and that brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt." Do not forget now that this was not the work of man, but it has been the work of God in the past for each of your leaders to be brought forth to save you and to guide you. So he says in verse 7, "Therefore stand still, that I may reason with you before the Lord." Now we'd like to note that religion, the truth, the faith that we are to believe in and follow, is a way of reason. It's a way that appeals to our intellect. It appeals to our ability to think and to know and to have the truth about something. It is not just a matter of emotion. It is not just a matter of being blindly led into something. But we must know. We must use our reasoning power. We must use our mental ability to fully discern and to know to the best of our ability what it is we're doing when we serve God. The New Testament says to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. There is a working out. There is a amount of reasoning power that is to be used. So here Samuel tells the people to stand still. Listen. Get your minds in tune with what I'm saying. I want to reason with you before the Lord of all the righteous acts of the Lord which he did to you and to your fathers. We want to talk about what the Lord has done, how he has dealt with you. And it's certainly well for each of us to stop and give some time of thought and meditation to reason as to what God has done to us and to our fathers, what God has done for the church, what God is intending for us to do and to be today in order to continue to be within the realm of his divine grace. So he says in verse 8, "When Jacob was come into Egypt, and your fathers cried unto the Lord." Now he reminds them of the time when they were brought into Egypt. Jacob came down searching for food for the family. They moved into Egypt and they lost their freedom. They became slaves to that government in Egypt. And their fathers cried unto the Lord. "Then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, which brought forth your fathers out of Egypt, and made them dwell in this place." All this deliverance from Egypt, all of this acquiring of a nation and of a land, this very place you're in today, was a result of what the Lord had done. The Lord brought this about. The Lord brought the deliverance about. The Lord raised Moses and Aaron up. This was not the work of man. It was not the work of the ingenuity of man. It was not because the people had selected a wise leader. It was the Lord that did all this. The Lord selected the leaders, and the Lord brought them forth. Then in verse 9, "And when they forget the Lord their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the host of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them." Now, the battles that they had encountered, the difficulties that they'd had, were a result of their having forgotten God, a result of them having not given God the proper honor and glory and respect, the result of them having taken other gods in His place. And consequently, this had brought many, many problems upon them. And he begins to name now some of the difficulties that they'd had that are well known in their history. There's no question in their mind that these things had occurred to them. And so he says, "And when they forget the Lord their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, the captain of the host of Hazor." Now, Sisera was a mighty opponent that the people did have to fight against. And we remember the story of Deborah and Barak as they encountered this great force. And he says, "And into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them." So they'd had trouble on every side. The Canaanites, the Philistines, the Moabites, and it was because they'd forgotten God. And so God sold them into the hand of these enemies. God allowed these enemies to come against them. God allowed them to have the difficulties that they had. "And they cried unto the Lord and said, We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served Balaam and Ashtaroth." And of course we know that Balaam means the he-gods and Ashtaroth means the she-gods. So all forms of idolatrous gods they had served. "But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies and we will serve thee." So the people realized that their mistake. They realized that they had been serving idolatrous gods, they've been serving the wrong gods, and so now they cry to the true God, "We're going to change, we're going to repent, so please deliver us out of the hands of our enemies, and we'll serve thee." So he proceeds in verse 11 to tell some of the things that God had done in this regard. "And the Lord sent Jerubbaal, and Bedan, and Jephthah, and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwell safe." Now we've read of the works of Jerubbaal in the book of Judges, who was actually Gideon, and of Jephthah. And this book that we're in now tells of the works of Samuel, how he had helped deliver them out of the hand of the Philistines. But Bedan is one that we have not read about. He is mentioned no place else except this particular passage, and all of the conjecture that might describe who he was and what he did and when he lived would only be that, just mere conjecture. But there was an event in which this person was instrumental in leading the people out of problems, out of a threat by an enemy, and God raised him up to do this, which is just simply not recorded. And we have to realize that there is probably much that happened to the people that is not recorded for us to know about any place. But they were delivered out of the hands of their enemies. Now, Samuel didn't mention himself out of pride, but he mentioned himself out of glory to God. And that would be the most immediate thing that this people could remember, the things that he had done in his guidance of them through the hand of God to deliver them out of the hand of the enemies. So they were delivered out of the hand of the enemies on every side, and you dwell safe. The reason that you're still alive today, the reason that you're safe today, is because God has been so merciful to you. And then he says in verse 12, when you saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, you said unto me, Nay, but a king shall reign over us when the Lord your God was your king. Now here you actually had the greatest king that could ever be. You had the Lord your God to lead you. He'd led you all this time, all these hundreds of years. You've been led by him and been successful. And you still had this same God. But now when you encountered this Nahash of the Ammonites, you said, We want a king. We want a king to reign over us, when you really had the Lord to be your king. And so this amounted to a rejection of God himself. So he says in verse 13, Now therefore behold the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. So now take a look at what you've gotten. You've got a man. You've got a king. This is what you wanted. It's what you desired. You have him. And behold the Lord has set a king over you. You've realized your desire. You have been allowed to have the thing that you wanted so badly. So now here it is. You have it. So he says in verse 14, If ye will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall both ye and also the king that reigneth over you continue following the Lord your God. Now, the way to go, Samuel says, is if you want to be successful, if you want to continue to do the right things, if you want to follow after the Lord, then you're going to have to fear the Lord and serve Him and obey His voice. Just because you have this man here in a place of leadership doesn't mean that now you can forget about God. It doesn't mean that he can take the place of God. It doesn't mean that you no longer obey the voice of God, but you still have to serve God and obey Him. But now you're going to be doing it with this man acting as more or less mediator between you and God, acting in the stead of a prophet or a judge in some ways, but you still have your obligation to God. This man being here, this king, does not change your obligation to serve God. And if you want to be successful, you will continue to serve God. But he says in verse 15, if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then shall the hand of the Lord be against you as it was against your fathers. Now, when you look at the thing from the other side, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord, if you rebel any of the commands of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord is going to be against you. And the fact that you have a king cannot save you nor preserve you from the judgment of God. Whether God reigns over you or not, you're going to be judged by God. And if you refuse to let God reign, then you're still going to have to face the judgment of God. So he's telling them very plainly that the fact that they have a king, the fact that they've been allowed to have a king, does not replace their duty to serve God, does not replace the commands of God, does not replace the fact that God is their true leader and God must have the last word in all things, that God is the everlasting authority. God is the true sovereign and the king is simply the delegated authority. So if you do not do this, the hand of the Lord will be against you as it was against your fathers. You're going to be in for the same problems that your fathers were up against. So we see here very wise and very prudent advice given by Samuel to the people, in spite of the fact that they had a king. And this same advice would apply to us today, regardless of what government we live under, regardless of what rule of law we happen to be residing in this world, we still must have God as our king. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.